So this is the first of a series of three talks I'm going to go do on the 10 paramis. The 10 paramis are a progressive description of what happens as you practice and life changes and develops over time. And I want to point out right from the beginning, this is not actually directly from the sutta. From the Buddhist, directly from the Buddhist teachings, it's from a commentary on the Buddhist teachings that came about 200 years after he passed. So it's, but it's well, really famous actually. You hear this referred to a lot, and I actually have a book here that I'm going to read from to start with. This is called Parami by Ajahn Susito, and he subtitled this Ways to Cross Life's Floods. The floods being the classic image that Buddhist teachings use a lot. And I just want to read a little bit from his introduction, just to sort of set the tone, I think, for what I'm going to say later. So, floods. Our experience is a meeting of merging. And merging of external and internal currents of events. The awareness of something out there triggers a moment of recognition as to what the thing is. A piece of music, an old friend, a familiar flavor, along with degrees of interest, pleasure, or alarm that may act as further triggers to action, to draw closer, start talking, or search one's memory for further information about that thing. This internal experience normally occupies our attention, sometimes to the point of congestion, as our minds add a swelling amount of internal activity to an ongoing flow of external data. Does that describe your mind sometimes? It certainly describes mine sometimes. The mind has creative potential, but that isn't always a happy experience. At times, the internal activity of analysis, speculation, memory, investigation, cross-referencing, decision-making, and self-evaluation can amount to a volume of overwhelming proportions. Then the experience of overload develops into one of exhaustion or of a pressure in our lives that diminishes peace and joy and can incline the mind to either the temporary oblivion offered by drink and drugs and entertainment or need for therapy to find some way to manage the daily round. This is the loss of balance that we can rightly experience as being flooded. It isn't the world per se, nor is it that we are chronically unbalanced. It's just that the right relationship hasn't been struck. This just describes so clearly our culture and how we can get caught up in it and overridden by it sometimes. Then he goes on, because on the other hand, we may have an experience of aware stillness in which the concerns of the day and all those habitual interactivities stopped or abated. Perhaps it was in the presence of a natural wonder, or maybe it was in a temple or under a night sky where we felt for a moment lifted by awe. For a few instants or minutes, perhaps, our normal sense of who we are, a sense of based on the movement and concerns of all that mental activity dropped away and replaced by a sense of great breadth or depth or of feeling as at one with the universe. In such an experience, the world around us changes to a place of beauty or spiritual presence. Maybe we frame the experience in the language of a particular religion or interpret it as a divine revelation. It could have triggered a whole range of such further activities. Or we could have surmised that there are other states of consciousness that we've called ordinary, and that the normal self that we experience as being in the world is not a fixed or ultimate identity. For a moment, without creating or rejecting anything, we experience a shift both in terms of ourself and the world around us. This is the action of the Paramis he's describing here. Yeah, he's cutting right to the chase at the beginning and saying, the Paramis and our understanding of them helps us make this shift into this more open place where we don't create or reject anything, which is what we are often doing. We're either trying to create things and figure things out, name them, or we're pushing them away because we don't want them. And what we're trying to do is learn how to be just this open, accepting heart mind. And the Paramis, in a sense, describe that process. So what are the Paramis? So there's 10, and I'm gonna talk with the first four tonight. Actually, I'll talk with the first two, and then I'll get to the second two. The first two are Dana and Sila. Generosity and virtue. I'm sure you've all heard me talk about this before. And heard me talk about this many times. But here it is once again. Where does practice begin? It begins at how we lead our lives in the world. It's so important that we understand this, that this is essential. And so why is dana always first? Why is generosity always first? And it's because anyone, no matter what their capabilities, their intellectual abilities, their profession, their whatever, their practice even, everyone can practice generosity. There's no one's ever excluded from the practice. So it's taught first to give people, encourage people, oh, here's a place to start. Just be generous. And it's the opposite of the world we live in, where often we're grasping things, trying to hold on to things. I mean, when we're grasping things, our fist is like this, we're holding on to it really tight, right? But when we're actually being generous, we have to open our hand and offer. It's a different physical experience, just that. And when we start being generous, we start by thinking of our possessions, the things that we use to carry on our daily lives, not so much as mine, but as just stuff. We cling to those things less. We're all, this is a teaching for householders, right? We're all householders. We all live in the world. We all need, vehicles to get around and, bank accounts and jobs and all those sorts of things, and a house and a, I have children. We got to take, a good place stuff for the kid, and all those things we have to deal with all the time. So it's not like we shouldn't have stuff. We're not like monastics where we have got a robe and a bowl. No, we have to actually have stuff, but we have to shift our attitude towards it. And we have the stuff because we need it now to function in the world. We have to, right? But we don't need to cling to these things. And generosity allows us to look at stuff and go, oh, I haven't used this in a year. I don't need this anymore. And give it away. That's generosity. Just, oh, let someone else can get some use out of this. Let's move it out into the world. It's simple as that. Just looking at our stuff and going, ah, okay. And we need to give gladly. We need to give with an open heart. It can't be like, well, I'm supposed to donate 10% of everything I have to the church. So, it's not like that at all. It's like something that it gladdens our heart. Because the quality of our feelings as we're giving really affects things. One of my teachers, Carol Wilson, tells this wonderful story. This is back 10 years ago, maybe a bit more. There was a huge typhoon that really devastated Burma. Anyone living anywhere near the coast was just like it destroyed huge amounts of it. But Burma at that time, to this day, had quite an authoritarian government, and they wouldn't let foreign aid into the country because it would
mean that they couldn't take care of their own citizens. This, of course, didn't stop Carol for one second. She gathered a whole bunch of money from all her friends, who all knew, because she had spent a lot of time practicing in Burma. In particular, she was connected with one particular group of nuns and monks who lived in the Delta area of Burma, which was just wiped out by this typhoon. So she gets to Rangoon. She has this money. She surreptitiously buys a huge amount of rice and gets a truck that'll drive her illegally to where this village is out in the boonies. And she arrives with like this huge amount of rice, and people there are starving because their crops, everything were just devastated. And she thought she was just going to, well, go there and she'll give all this stuff to the monks, because the monks will then make sure it gets distributed fairly to everybody. And the abbot goes, oh no, you can't do that. You can't just, give it to us and then take off. You have to actually be here and give it to the people yourself. You have to be here, if at least symbolically, you have to be there to actually give it. You have to actually experience the whole thing with a very open heart and deal with what you see, because it's pretty scary. So the next day, all the villagers are told, that these people have brought rice and everybody should come and get rice. And people are showing up and they have like old battered containers and, whatever they got. Some people come, mostly men who are coming. And like the men would take off their shirt because that was the only thing they had. And they'd get the rice poured into the shirt and then pull up the four corners and make a little bundle, and off they'd go with their rice to feed their families. And this went on like this huge line of people, and Carol had to stand there, and everybody was blessing her and thanking her. And she thought, well, that's the end of the experience, she thought, right? So then the next day, the monastics, of course, are totally dependent on the householders for food, because they're not allowed to cook the rice. They have all this rice, but they can't cook it. They got to gave it, literally gave all the rice away. And so they're going to go and do donor round. And so they go down with their bowl and they're walking through the village. And they all come back with these really full bowls, and they're all in tears. And the abbot and Carol are going like, what's going on? Why are you crying so much? And they said, everywhere we went, every household, not only were they giving us cooked rice, but they had all the children out there, even the youngest children, with a little spoon or something, and all of the children put something in our bowls. They were teaching their children right away to be generous, that this was part of what life was important about. And the monks were just like so touched by this. Everybody had the right attitude. The monks had the right attitude. They gave it all away right away. The people who received it, they gave it back, some of it back right away, so the monks could eat, because the monks couldn't eat if the villagers didn't give food. This is generosity. This is what dana is all about, this reciprocal relationship. And it doesn't have to be, it doesn't have to be with monastics. It can be with anyone. You hear someone who needs something, let's give them something. It's a different way of thinking. Part of generosity too is allowing other people to be generous. This is hard for some of us because we like, I don't need that. I got lots of good stuff. I don't need that. Like in this Carol story, the next day after that, some of the villagers came, and one of them had like this old bucket with a broken handle, right? But she wanted to give something to Carol. And Carol just took it and like, oh, it was like the biggest treasure she ever saw, right? Because she wanted to let this person feel generous. And that's, we if we let people give us stuff, even if we don't want it, we don't need it. It's like we're so easy for us to go, oh, who wants that stuff? I already have one of those. Well, whatever. We say all kinds of excuses not to take things when people offer them. Always take it. Always take it. Let people be generous. And then if you don't really need it, then you pass it on to someone else later. You know, because once something's given, it's given. No one, you don't, it's like, you don't have an obligation to use it or anything. You just take it. Let people be generous. Generosity has, the thing about generosity is there's three kinds of joy involved. That's another reason the Buddha taught, because the Buddha was like, wanted people to be happy, right? So when you think about generosity, the first time you feel joy is when you think about giving something. Just the thought of it, the thought of being generous, generates feelings of joy in your heart. And then the actual act of giving, she discovered, being there where all these people came and got what they really needed because they were really hungry and their children were hungry, it just filled her heart with joy. The actual giving. And then thinking about it later. Or telling stories about it like she did. And now I'm telling the story 10 years later, right? I mean, this is like, this, the energy just goes on and on and on. And it just keeps bringing more joy. It's the nature of generosity. And the last thing I want to mention, or almost the last thing, is we have to be careful. In our culture, we often think of generosity as giving money, right? But I think in our culture, it's much more important that we give our time, that we do things for other people without any expectation of reward at all. You know, whether you're volunteering, you know. I never agreed with much of what George Bush said back in the early aughts, but I love the fact that he always talked about the 1,000 points of light. He stressed, really stressed, the importance for generosity in our culture. And it's just so generous to just give your time, which is a, you know, we're all busy people, and it's like, this is a precious commodity, and we just give it away to someplace or someone who needs it. You can find a place to volunteer that's really going to be useful, that suits your nature in like 30 seconds. If you Google volunteers needed or something like that, watch your email box will be flooded with stuff. But just think about that as a way you can be generous. And generosity, the other beauty of generosity is it's so easy to practice. It's not like we have to have any great, wise knowledge or anything. We just give. Joseph Goldstein, one of my teachers, said, when I was sitting in Sangha with him once, he said, the thing about generosity is as soon as you have the impulse, as soon as you have the thought of doing something generous, do it right away. Do it. It always feels good. If you have the impulse to be generous, just do it. Don't hesitate for a second. So that's the first of the paramis, dana and generosity. Then comes sila. Sila is a word that often gets translated as virtue, which is kind of an old-fashioned word, right? We don't talk much about virtue in our culture. You know, we talk a lot about morality, but not a lot about virtue. I want to just read a little bit here. This is from the Majjhima Nikaya. And this is the Buddha. Someone has come to the Buddha and asked him how he trains his disciples. This is what he says. It is possible, Brahman, to describe gradual training, gradual practice, and gradual progress in this Dhamma and discipline. Just as, Brahman, when a clever horse trainer obtains a fine thoroughbred colt, he first makes him get used to wearing the bit, and afterwards trains him further. So this is an image that everybody in the culture would understand, right? So when I obtain a person to be tamed, he first disciplines himself thus. Come, bhikkhus, be virtuous, restrained with the restraint of the patimokkha, which is the the rules of discipline. Be perfect in conduct and resort, and seeing fear in the slightest fault, train by undertaking the training precepts. First, this is for someone who's going to actually do the serious practice. First, virtue. It's this, and I could show you 20 other places in the suttas where the Buddha says exactly the same thing. This is like a continuing theme. Dana and sila. So in our household or world, the idea of virtue is defined typically or taught typically by what's called the five precepts. Yeah, these are things that we try and cultivate, habits of heart mind that we try and cultivate. You know, non-harming, taking only what is offered, not using wrong speech, refraining from sexual misconduct, and not abusing intoxicants. And the Buddha just talked about this all the time. In the context of sila being the first essential step taken when taking up the practice. In fact, this is another example like this one. So this is from the Anguttara Nikaya. Anguttara means the numerical discourses. So this is the first, this is in the chapter of tens. You know, so much of the Buddha's teaching was numerical. I'd like the eight this and the nine that and the six this. This is the tens. And on one occasion, the Blessed One was dwelling at Savatthi. At the time, the Venerable Ananda approached the Blessed One, paid homage to him, and said, "What, Lord, is the benefit of virtuous ways of conduct? What is their reward?" "Non-remorse, Ananda, is the benefit and reward of virtuous ways of conduct." This is so important. Like, non-remorse seems like non-remorse, right? What? So what? But it's like, if we've acted in a place that has not been virtuous, then we carry with it in our heart minds, you know, guilt, remorse, worry that someone's going to find out, self-blame, we beat ourselves up, all the turmoil of the heart mind that comes out of not acting virtuously. So non-remorse. "And what, Lord, is the benefit and reward of non-remorse?" "Gladness, Ananda." "And what, Lord, is the benefit of gladness?" "Joy." "And what is the benefit of reward of joy?" "Serenity." "And what, Lord, is the benefit and reward of serenity?" "Happiness." "And what, Lord, is the benefit and reward of happiness?" "Concentration of mind." "And what, Lord, is the benefit and reward of concentration?" "Knowledge and vision of things as they really are." "And what, Lord, is the benefit and reward of knowledge and vision of things as they really are?" "Revulsion and dispassion," like understanding that we need to be serious. "And what, Lord, is the benefit of reward and reward of revulsion and dispassion?" The knowledge and vision of liberation. See, there's many versions of this in different suttas, though I like this one just because it's so straightforward. Just Ananda asking these questions and Buddha giving him these one-word answers, right? And then, of course, which just generates another question, which is how our mind works. But you notice it started with virtue, and where did it end up? It ended up in liberation. This is a constant theme in the Buddhist teachings. We can't skip over this. Here's the problem, however. The thing about virtue is, and let's contrast it with morality. Morality is this set of rules. Follow these rules. The Ten Commandments, whatever set of rules you happen to be following. Or else. There's always an or else at the end of a list of moral precepts. It's like, do this or you're going to be banned from the community. You're going to be shunned. You're going to burn in hell for the rest of your life, you know, if you don't straighten up. There's like this element of fear built into morality. Fear of something really bad happening because you weren't moral. And that just doesn't exist in virtue. Virtue is basically just says, here's these wholesome ideas of how to live a life in the world. Practice them. There's an understanding, because it's called practice, right? That we're not going to be perfect. But we can practice these things and gradually over time have more and more non-remorse, right? And it's a different way of doing, of looking at how to live in the world without the wagging finger part of morality. But, it's always a but. The thing about trying to live a virtuous life, it's if we're not careful, we catch ourselves in the mind state of, well, this is okay, or it's okay this time. I'll only do it this once, or whatever, funny words we choose that, fit in there. And so, and then the advantage of strict moral guidelines is they're straightforward. This is what you do. Period. Virtue is, this is a practice. Figure it out for yourself on what these things mean for you. And look at your life all the time. And every time you're making a decision, try and make a decision that's virtuous. And understand what that means. That this takes practice. To lead a virtuous life is something that we have to be consciously aware of and practice. But it is the underpinning of all meditative practice. Being virtuous allows us to have a calm, still mind because we're not caught up in the worry of non-virtue. So, I want to read something I wrote here actually. Being virtuous may be more difficult than being moral, but it's the underpinning of all meditative practice. Non-harming leads to compassion. Taking only what is offered leads to generosity. Right speech leads to truthfulness. Refraining from sexual misconduct leads to loving kindness for all beings. Not abusing intoxicants leads to clarity of mind. They all lead into something wholesome by practicing the precepts. This is from, oops, let me get the wrong book. This is from the Dhammapada. This is verse 19 and 20. It says, and he's talking about, the Dhammapada is a sort of collection of pithy sayings of the Buddha that's sort of organized into topics in some sense. If he recites many teachings, but heedless man doesn't do what they say, like a cowherd counting the cattle of others, he has no share in the contemplative life. So you can know what these things are, but if you don't practice them, not going to do you much good. Then he goes on. If he recites next to nothing, but follows the Dhamma, in line with the Dhamma, abandoning passion, aversion, delusion, alert, his mind well released, not clinging, either here or hereafter, he has his share in the contemplative life. So this business about reciting, this is like he's talking about the Brahmins who could recite everything. That was their job in a sense, but didn't often follow the teachings at all. They could just do the recitations. And we know people like this in our culture, in our world, where people, can cite, quote you chapter and verse of some famous speech or, some quotation from the Bible or whatever. But don't practice. And the Buddhist, what he's saying here is he follows the Dhamma, he actually practices. That's what gives us a share in the contemplative life. Now, one last thing. This is the yellow warning flag part of the talk. Don't think for one second that this is saying you have to be perfect, which is just a dead end. Perfection is just a source of struggle and pain and suffering. Trying to be perfect will only lead to suffering. We're not trying to be perfect, we're trying to slowly move towards perfection. It's all about the process, not the end point. If we think, I have to be perfect, then we're always going to end up beating ourselves up because we're human beings and we're going to mess up. Guaranteed. Just the nature of being a human being. So those are the first two paramis. Dana and Sila, generosity and virtue. Then the Buddha shifts into the third and parami. Now he's going to start talking about, well, what are the results? If I actually lead this wholesome and virtuous life and I'm generous, then what happens? And what comes next is renunciation. Everybody's going, boo, boo. You know, renunciation is like not something that everybody goes, oh boy. And partly it's, you know, renunciation has a bad name in our culture, especially in our sort of spiritual culture of this last 50 years or so, because so many, quote, renunciates have been anything but. And they've acted, and both men and women, both monks and nuns, have acted very inappropriately, taken advantage of people, amassed great wealth, done all kinds of things that were not virtuous, shall we say. And so that's part of it. And then the other part is our whole culture glorifies getting everything you can and not doing anything that isn't pleasurable, which sort of is the opposite of renunciation, right? So why would we have to renounce? Well, first of all, to lead a generous and virtuous life, just that, means you've probably renounced some things already. Because it's so against the flow of our culture to live that way. You've stopped doing things that other people do, not because they're bad or wrong, but just because you see they lead you to a place that isn't wholesome, that isn't helpful. It's like what we're doing is renouncing, in a sense, what is commonly believed to be the source of happiness. You know, accumulating things and seeking pleasure. Not that owning many things or experiencing pleasure is bad or wrong. I want to make that really clear. They simply don't work as a way of making ourselves happy. They are unsatisfactory ways of achieving happiness. And as soon as we start to meditate, as soon as we start to actually seriously take up the practice, we are always faced with decisions. You know, we have busy lives. If I'm going to sit for half an hour every day, what is it I'm not going to do every day that I've been doing up until now? Because every day gets filled up with stuff, right? Just inevitably. So I have to renounce something, because I think this is more important. And that's where renunciation comes in. It's like we have to go, oh, practice is more important, so maybe I don't read the entire New York Times every day, that would be me. Instead, just I'll read the headlines and a few key articles that catch my attention. Less New York Times, more time for practice. And so you have to give something up to have time to do that. And then if you're doing some study and you're going down on retreats and those sorts of things, you keep giving up more and more of your time that you would spend in doing other things to do the practice instead. This is another verse from the Dhammapada. The path of material gain goes one way, the way of unbinding another. Realizing this, the monk, a disciple of the awakened one, should not relish offerings, should cultivate seclusion instead. In other words, there were monastics in other groups and in the Buddhist groups too, I'm sure, who became monastics so they could then, sit in the village with their begging bowl and not have to work and they'd get fed. They were relishing the offerings that were made to monastics because they were holy and people were supposed to take care of them. That was a culture, right? And they did it strictly so they didn't, they could lead an easy life, as opposed to, cultivate seclusion instead. Well, if you go in seclusion, there's no one handing you stuff all the time. It's pointing to the need to not to renounce even that for a monastic. The generosity of people, you still have to do it. Once a day, you go on your dhamma rounds. But that's it. Interestingly enough, the Buddha talked about the joy of renunciation. Seems like an oxymoron, right? The joy of renunciation. But it's a letting go, a release of things that you've come to see as not as important or even useful. It is the result of right understanding, of seeing that some of the things you do in your daily life don't lead you towards enlightenment, but instead weigh you down or hold you back. The weight of having to do things like everyone else, the desire to be normal, is undone by renunciation. I think it was like, no, I don't have to be normal. I don't have to, be like everyone else. What a relief. Just renounce that. This is something you can renounce. Like, oh, I don't need to do that anymore. If you renounce that the artificial need to conform, that feeling that you just don't measure up to the impossible standard of perfection that our culture is pervaded by. Because our culture is pervaded by this idea that you have to be in, cool, hip, beautiful, blah, 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 name your adverb or whatever that is. And it's like impossible to live up to that. Impossible to be that person that the culture says everybody should want to be. Just renounce it. I don't need to do that. And renounce the idea that I can't do that. This is another thing that's worth renouncing. Like, I can't do that. I mean, just renounce that. Sure, you can do it. You can do whatever you want. I can't work towards enlightenment. Just renounce that idea. But, yeah, there's always a but, right? Remember that renunciation can't be forced. You can't sort of go, well, I'm just going to give up everything and just sit here and meditate all day long and that's it. Yeah, that doesn't work either. We're householders. We live in the world, number one. And it's like you can turn this into some sort of fierce desire to be enlightened within 6 weeks, right? Or whatever. And it just becomes another desire. Now I'm just caught in wanting something else. I'm wanting to become an enlightened being right away. I'm wanting to be one of those cool people who everybody looks up to because I'm so holy. That doesn't work either. Okay. Renunciation has got to be very sort of stepwise. Little bit, little bit, little bit. We keep looking at our lives and keep going back and like, oh, I don't need to have that in my life anymore, that way of being or that way of thinking or whatever. I can just renounce it. Another verse from the Dhammapada. If, by forsaking a limited happiness, you would see an abundance of happiness, the enlightened man would forsake the limited happiness for the sake of the abundant. So yes, all those things that our culture tells us make us happy, to a limited extent, they do. Not all of them, but some of them anyway. Like a good meal or, going for a night, all those things we like to do bring happiness for the moment, but they're a limited happiness. And when we start to understand the Buddhist teachings, we see that there's an abundant happiness available to us by following the teachings. So renunciation is, in a sense, one way I like to think about it, the gateway to right understanding. Once we start really looking at our lives and saying, "Oh, I can let that go, I can let that go," that means right understanding has arisen in us. We've got, I actually have to do something to practice this. These teachings aren't just interesting philosophical ideas. These are suggestions for how we can practice in the world. And this is, renunciation is this shift away from the world to a certain extent. But we can't shift totally away from it. We have to just choose wisely what we renounce, what we let go. So that's the third of the paramis. And then, interestingly enough, the next parami is wisdom. This is the result of the first three. Now, wisdom starts to arise. This is once again from the Dhammapada. From practice comes wisdom. From not practicing, wisdom's end. Knowing these two courses, development or decline, conduct yourself so wisdom will grow. Very straightforward. It's like, from practice comes wisdom. From not practicing, wisdom's end. So pick one. And so this is like wisdom starts to arise directly out of the earlier paramis. There are wisdom starts to arise because we've got our life in order and we've started to get serious about things. So this trouble with the word wisdom, it's kind of tricky in and of itself. What does wisdom mean, right? And there's sort of three forms of wisdom, three layers of wisdom, you might call it, three kinds of wisdom. That arises from study, that which arises from reflection on what we've studied, and that which arises from practicing what we study. Three different things, right? So, study is an essential part of the practice. I believe this really firmly. It's not for everyone, because some people just have a natural tendency to be, pure and open-hearted. For the rest of us, especially with our Western background, study is a natural thing for us to do. And the benefit of study is that now we're actually practicing, and something arises in our heart mind, and we go, "Oh, that's like that thing that guy was talking about in that Dharma talk the other day, or that thing I read in, so and so's book or whatever." It's like we start to have context for what's arising, which is really useful. In practice, to have context. It isn't essential, but it's really useful. It gives us a framework or a point of reference for how this all fits together. The problem with this kind of wisdom, however, this is primarily mental. It gives you a set of ideas to believe in, but you actually haven't experienced the truth of these things yet. They're still just ideas. You may understand what you've read and studied, but you don't know it. You haven't experienced it. Different kind of wisdom. Then comes reflection. And reflection is the process of looking at the knowledge we have gained from study and consciously challenging it. Challenging it. The knowledge gained helps you to recognize what is arising in the moment. And it gives you a frame, you know, gives you this framework. And then reflection, you go, oh, wait a second. I suppose I could look at it from over here. Or I could look at it from this point of view. Or, you know, all those other ways of thinking about things. And you just start to literally challenge your thinking and see if you can see it from three or four other angles. The Dalai Lama has this great line, we should look at everything from six different points of view. If you really look at it from six different points of view, then your understanding is much broader and you're much more sympathetic to people who have very different points of view than you. Also, another layer of reflection is that it's sometimes useful to have what are called Dhamma discussions. You know, you hang out with other people who are equally interested and you discuss something. And this is called, what's called in the tradition called Kalyanamitta, spiritual friends, where you have, because then you meet people who've studied exactly the same text or book or story or whatever, and have this totally different idea of what it means. And you go, gee, I never thought of it quite that way before. And as long as it's not like an argument, no sense arguing about this stuff. It's just like, oh, that's a different way of looking at it. And it sort of makes our understanding of what we're studying much crisper, much clearer. But this thing about reflection is this form of knowledge, of wisdom, is still at the level of discursive thought. It still needs it to be integrated into some level of personal experience. And the third form of wisdom arises directly out of insights gained from meditative practice. And this wisdom is the blossoming of right understanding, seeing the truth of the three characteristics, unsatisfactoriness, impermanence, and not-self. The Seven Factors of Awakening, the teachings on that particular list, this is called Dhammavacaya, you know, investigation of the truth. And conventional life is unsatisfactory because much as you can't make yourself happy by grasping at what is pleasurable and resisting what is unpleasant. Because things are always changing. There's this impermanence lying underneath everything. And even though we think, I finally got this good thing, and I gotta hold on to it, it's gone. It might be in 5 seconds, or it might be in 5 years, but it's gonna be gone. Everything is changing, and everything is impermanent. Everything goes, without exception. And so, that's an important thing, where we start to actually not see these things as theories, but experientially, in a non-intellectual way, we start to grasp the truth of the Buddhist teachings. I want to read a little bit from Joseph Goldstein here, where he's talking about this, and he's talking about mindfulness and its close association with wisdom. This comes about through bare attention and clear comprehension. The quality of bare attention can manifest on different levels and is called different things in various Buddhist traditions. Mindfulness, naked awareness, innate wakefulness. It is naked and bare because it is simple, direct, non-interfering, and non-judging. Those are all aspects of wisdom. It's simple. It's direct. It doesn't interfere or try and make things something other than they are. And it doesn't judge things at all. It just sees them for what they are. And the other aspect of mindfulness closely associated with wisdom and conducive to its arising is called clear comprehension. This means seeing something precisely, thoroughly, from all sides, as I was just talking about.
Clear comprehension broadens the practice of bare attention from a narrow focus to one that sees things in context. This salient understanding highlights the importance of using the power of mindfulness in the service of wisdom. This is a really interesting point, I think. As Sayadaw Tenjaniya has emphasized, awareness alone is not enough. For mindfulness to function as a factor of awakening, it has to be the springboard for investigation. When mindfulness brings us face to face with the object, what do we learn? It is this investigative aspect of non-delusion that is the direct link to awakening. So he's saying that mindfulness, being able to have, you know, see things clearly and stay with the object of meditation, is really useful, but it has to lead to something more than that. And I want to tell you a little story. Okay? This is a personal story. One of my longer retreats. It's a month-long retreat, and I was quite practicing quite diligently because I did one of these long retreats I used to do all the time. And one of the things on retreat, you people have, you know, we have little tasks that you do. So I was ringing the bell for the 2 o'clock sit, right? And so I was very, at this point, in this particular moment in time, very concentrated and very sort of still and focused mentally, but still functioning in the world, like, oh, I'm remembering I gotta ring the bell, right? And so I go up and I go to where the bell is, which is this big thing, and it's got a hammer, and I pick up the hammer, and I'm aware of the hammer in my hand, and I'm aware of my arms swinging through space, and I'm aware of, you know, the hammer striking the bell, and the sound of the bell reverberating, and my hand shake. You know, it's just totally tuned in to the process of just ringing the bell, like very mindful of every little bit of what was happening. And then, you know, I hang the hammer back up on the support for the bell, and I turn and I walk away, and I walk maybe one or two paces, and in my mind, the thought arises, you may never ring that bell again. And it was like, huh? There's a little pause. And then in my mind, the next thought arises, well, of course, retreat shows us a couple more days, I'll ring the bell again tomorrow. And then it was like, oh, but I don't know, I'm going to be here tomorrow. Who knows? I was believing that I was going to be there tomorrow to ring the bell. I thought I was permanent. And intellectually, I thought I understood impermanence, right? Oh yeah, I understand that stuff. But it was like, and yeah, this body's going to disappear someday. But it was always like, but not for another 20 years or so. That was my understanding of impermanence. Well, it's going to happen, but who knows when? Long, way out there someplace where I can't even see it, right? But the truth is, I was totally impermanent, and who knew that I could be there to ring that bell tomorrow? This, like, it was like, wow. It just sunk into me so clearly that this was like, this was just me believing that somehow I was permanent, that I was going to continue on for a long time, as opposed to, who knows? Am I going to be there tomorrow to ring the bell? I really didn't have a clue. I really looked at it. My thought, you may never ring the bell again, was a perfectly accurate statement of impermanence. And it was like a wake-up. Oh, that's what they meant when they talked about impermanence. It was like this, like, for me, this is like changing from intellectual understanding to visceral experience. And it just shifted my whole view of many things in my life when I could, you know, look back. It's just
Who knows? We don't. We think we think somehow we got things all figured out, right? And here's the important thing. Study and reflection had prepared me for that moment. I'd studied, I understood the ideas behind the teachings on impermanence and reflected on them with other people and looked at all kinds of different sources and stuff like that. And without that, that whole moment would have just gone by. But because I was being very mindful and I had this understanding, this intellectual understanding, when that moment of experiencing impermanence for what it really was arose, it was like, oh, that's what all that stuff has been about. Duh. You know, it's like it just sunk in a totally different way because I'd done all that work to prepare myself for that moment. And I was being very mindful, of course. So, I think a dedicated practitioner needs all three of these kinds of wisdom. You know, we have to find time to study, and whether that's study by listening to Dharma talks like this, or listening to Dharma talks online from Dharma Seed or whatever, or you know, reading particular books that are commentaries on the tradition. There's lots of ways you can study, but I think study in and of itself is important, and then. That idea of reflection, of actually challenging what you know, is also quite skillful. Like, because the problem is our mind habits are like, oh, I've got this one figured out. I know this one. And then we don't think about it anymore. Instead, we have to go, oh, well, I haven't thought about this for a while. I never thought of it quite that way. And look at what this person is saying. It's very different. You know, I find it fascinating to read people's definitions of mindfulness, for instance. You can read five different definitions and you go, they're all talking about the same thing? And it's really ancient. Like it pushes you to think, oh, I never thought of it quite that way before. That sort of thing. And then, of course, the key is just the practice. Practice, practice, practice. That's really what it comes down to. There is some. Couple more things I want to share. This is a teaching called the Two Wings of Dhamma that Joseph Goldstein likes so much. He's writing about it here. Wisdom and love are the two wings of Dhamma. So this is reminding us. Oh, it isn't just about wisdom. It's very easy to turn this into just like another university course and I'll gather all this wisdom and knowledge. But without an open heart, wisdom isn't particularly useful. Whether we are in the swirl of a busy life or in the deep, still silence of retreat, a clear mind and an open heart are the paramount forces we cultivate as both the means and the end of our path. These wonderful qualities of mind and heart are not exclusive virtues of renunciates and Asian masters. They are universal powers, and they show up in the most unlikely places. In some ways, an active lay person's life provides us with continual opportunities for not only cultivating, but also manifesting wisdom and love. And that's cultivating is the key word there. Like, we have to cultivate these things. These are things we practice by cultivating them. One more little thing. This is from Dana Fall's book, Go One Soul. And she's talking about what I've been talking about in a sense. It's called Intimate with All Things. The Buddha said, I'm intimate with all things. Imagine that. To be on the same close terms with the suffering and panic as bliss and rapture. To know the souls of water buffalo as surely as my own. To push away nothing. To let the bitter and sweet taste of life linger.
to see the beloved in everything, and when that isn't my experience, to be intimate with self-hatred, unmet preferences, and the many ways I don't show up as saintly. Imagine that. He's talking about being okay with the fact that we're not perfect. That's the other thing I always want to take away when I'm talking about it, teaching the paramis. It's so easy. I mean, you see this sometimes, the word parami gets translated as perfections of the heart or perfections of the heart mind. And as soon as I see the word perfection, my quills go up. Oh, I'm not perfect. And it's not. It's like, it's being okay and being intimate with the fact that we're not perfect. It's sometimes the most skillful thing we can do. That sometimes I'm anything but perfect. Most of the time, as a matter of fact, I'm anything but perfect. And just being aware of that and being okay with that. That's part of the practice.